If your vibe is the earlier the better, Lowe's early Black Friday deals are a no-brainer. Get up to 35% off select major appliances, and rewards members get free delivery, haul-away, basic installation, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 11/4. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change. LG member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is a True Crime in Real Time update. The latest on the biggest cases we're following at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
You want to talk about pressure? Picture this: a Manhattan federal courtroom packed with media, federal prosecutors, high-profile defense attorneys, and in the middle of it all, Sean Diddy Combs, sitting quietly in a tailored suit, not a prison jumpsuit. Because yes, the court granted his request to dress out. He's staring down the possibility of a life sentence, and as of May 5th, 2025, the very first task of this high-stakes trial kicked off, not with drama in the form of testimony, not with a bombshell exhibit, but with something far more procedural and equally make-or-break jury selection. And jury selection in a case like this? It's not some quick process of raising hands and getting 12 people into a box. It's an exhaustive, meticulous vetting system designed to filter out anyone who might come into this courtroom with an opinion already baked in. Which, let's face it, is a tough ask in the digital age, especially when your defendant is an international music mogul with a decades-long career, a string of civil lawsuits behind him, and now a criminal indictment involving racketeering, sex trafficking, and prostitution-related offenses. The stakes here aren't just high, they're federal. Day one began with a goal set firmly by Judge Aaron Subramanian. Qualify at least 45 potential jurors, not seat them. Just get 45 individuals who could potentially be trusted to listen impartially to evidence in what's expected to be an 8-week trial. That 45 gives wiggle room. It lets the prosecution and the defense each use their allowed peremptory strikes, you know, the I don't like this person's vibe kind of dismissal, without running out of people to pull from. Because in a case this charged, no one's taking chances. Now, this wasn't done by tossing a few questions to a room full of people and moving on. This was slow, one at a time voir dire. 32 potential jurors were individually questioned on that first day alone, with only 19 making the cut. Some were dismissed for expressing strong opinions about Diddy based on past news coverage. Others were honest about life circumstances. They couldn't serve because of financial hardship or childcare issues, or because they simply didn't think they could be impartial. And in a move that didn't go unnoticed, the judge reminded everyone that this case isn't about celebrity. It's about the facts, the evidence, the law. Still, the ghost of the public image loomed large. Even among those who said they could be fair, there were moments where the shadows of past headlines flickered through. Diddy sat silently through all of this. No outbursts, no comments. Just that reserved tension of someone who knows the jury being chosen right now could decide whether he dies in prison. But it wasn't all sterile legal choreography. Toward the end of the day, prosecutors dropped a note that one of their key witnesses, identified in court documents only as Victim 3, might not appear. Not because she's disappeared. Not because she recanted. Simply because she doesn't live locally and hasn't been responsive, even though she was subpoenaed. Her attorney reportedly told the court he's having trouble communicating with her, which introduces an early tremor. Not enough to shake the trial's foundation yet, but enough to remind us all that even with airtight paperwork, human unpredictability is always in the mix. And then came Tuesday, day two. And with it, the pressure cranked up a notch. The court still needed 10 more qualified jurors to hit that magic number of 45. Judge Subramanian, who had kept things calm and efficient so far, didn't sugarcoat it. "We are running out of time," he told both parties. Because if they didn't get that pool locked down soon, opening statements might have to be delayed. And no one wanted to blow the schedule. Again, individual questioning dominated the day. More jurors were excused for bias. One guy admitted he smoked weed every night and wasn't willing to stop during trial. Another openly said he'd watched a viral 2016 video allegedly showing Diddy assaulting a woman, and he couldn't say it didn't shape his view. Others, however, were more complicated. One woman admitted to seeing the same video but insisted she could remain neutral, and the court kept her. Because impartiality isn't about erasing memory. It's about whether you can set it aside and judge based on what's presented at trial. It's a tightrope, and Judge Subramanian walked it carefully. But jury questioning wasn't the only fire burning that day. Off to the side, a separate issue flared up involving none other than Mark Garagos. Now, Garagos isn't officially listed as Diddy's defense attorney, but he's advising the team, and apparently he couldn't resist sharing his thoughts about the case on a podcast. Yes, you heard that right. Just days before jury selection began, Mark took to his mic and threw shade at the prosecutors, referring to them as a six-pack of white women. Not only is that professionally tone-deaf, it also dances dangerously close to violating the court's gag order. The prosecution wasn't amused. They filed a motion asking the court to clamp down, reminding everyone that even off-the-record advisors need to keep their mouths shut once the wheels of justice are turning. Judge Subramanian didn't let it slide. Before court resumed, he addressed Mark directly, calling the remarks outrageous and unacceptable in any courtroom in America. It wasn't a screaming match. It was worse. It was surgical. The judge delivered the kind of quiet, cutting admonition that leaves no room for misinterpretation. Mark accepted the rebuke and sat back down. But the message was clear. This isn't a circus. The rules apply to everyone. By the end of the second day, they had 35 jurors qualified, close, but not quite there. And with each day that passed, the urgency built. Because this wasn't just about picking people. It was about making sure none of those people would wake up 3 days into trial and say, you know what, I can't do this. That's why every dismissal mattered. That's why every word from Mark mattered. That's why every hesitation from a potential witness mattered. And so we left day two with a lot of gears turning. A nearly complete jury pool. A courtroom that had just been reminded that even off-camera behavior can derail a case. And a defendant sitting there, silent, still, and fully aware that the walls are closing in, not with a bang, but with procedural precision. The jury isn't seated yet. The opening statements haven't been made. But the trial is no longer theoretical. The machinery is in motion, and the process is unfolding in real time, right in front of us. All the public perception, the media commentary, the civil lawsuits and tabloid headlines, they don't count for anything if the 12 people who ultimately hear this case decide there's not enough to convict. But before we even get to that decision, we've got to get those 12 in the box. By the time Wednesday rolled around in the federal courtroom of Judge Aaron Subramanian, you could feel it. Everyone was on edge, but not in a chaotic way. It was more like that tense stillness right before the curtain rises. The courtroom wasn't yet full of witnesses or legal fireworks, but every seat felt like it mattered. This was the final push in the slow, deliberate marathon of jury selection. No drama, no theatrics, just focused pressure as both the prosecution and defense closed in on their goal. A fully vetted pool of 45 prospective jurors, and here's why that number mattered. They weren't just trying to get 12 people to sit in a box and hear testimony. They needed enough qualified candidates to survive the next round, peremptory strikes, those no-questions-asked dismissals that both legal teams get to use when they sense, for any reason at all, that a juror might not be their best bet. You can't run out of names when you get to that stage. So the goal was to stack the deck with enough people who passed the first filter, so that once those strikes started flying, there'd still be 12 plus 6 alternates left standing. Midway through the day, they hit that mark. 45 potential jurors individually questioned, screened for bias, hardship, and anything that might crack the foundation of a fair trial. It took days of slow work, hours of judges asking delicate questions, attorneys probing attitudes and beliefs. But by Wednesday, the pool was locked. They were ready to move into final jury selection. Well, almost. Just as things seemed set to transition smoothly into the next phase, the defense flagged a concern. one of the jurors who had made it through the gauntlet was employed by HBO. That might not sound like a big deal at first glance until you remember that HBO had recently produced a documentary that directly referenced Combs. The juror didn't work on the film, and she hadn't claimed to have watched it, but that wasn't the point. The optics alone, being employed by a company that had distributed potentially prejudicial material about the defendant, was enough to raise alarm bells on the defense side. They made their case. Any potential association with that kind of content, even if indirect, risked influencing the jury room. The judge agreed. That juror was dismissed for cause, no peremptory strike needed. One more name off the list. But the defense walked away with what they wanted, a cleaner pool with fewer loose ends. Now, with the qualified panel more or less in place, the courtroom shifted gears. It was time to figure out when they'd move to final jury seating. That next step, where both sides start using their discretionary strikes to whittle down the 45 to the final 12 jurors and 6 alternates, was always the next domino to fall. But it didn't fall on Wednesday. Instead, the court made a tactical pivot. Judge Subramanian, always careful to keep this process tight, took a moment to consider something that wasn't about rules or procedure, but about human behavior. He raised a real-world concern. If the jury were seated too early, say on Wednesday or Thursday, they'd essentially be sent home for a long weekend before the trial officially started. Opening statements weren't scheduled until Monday, May 12th. That left a window, and windows like that can be dangerous. Not because the jurors were going to go rogue or break rules, but because the longer people have to stew in a commitment, especially one that lasts 2 months, with the weight of a high-profile criminal trial on their shoulders, the more likely they are to second-guess their ability to follow through. You can plan around legal challenges. What you can't plan for is a juror calling on Sunday night with cold feet. So Judge Subramanian did something smart. He pushed the final phase, those peremptory strikes and the formal seating of the jury, off to Friday, May 9th. That way, once the jurors were sworn in, there wouldn't be a long pause. They'd return to court the next business day, and the trial would begin immediately with opening statements. No downtime, no gaps, no chance for anxiety to unravel the lineup. Both sides agreed. The prosecution, led by Assistant U.S. Attorney Maureen Comey, and the defense, now including high-profile legal names under the microscope thanks to prior courtroom comments, didn't raise objections. Everyone understood the logic. It wasn't about buying time or stalling. It was about protecting the integrity of the process. You don't spend 3 days building a pool of jurors just to watch them evaporate because the weekend gave them too much time to panic. There was also the matter of anonymity. From the start, the court had made it clear this would be an anonymous jury. That decision wasn't taken lightly, but it was necessary. This isn't a neighborhood dispute or a low-profile tax case. It's a federal trial involving a globally recognized figure, already surrounded by tabloid noise, civil suits, media narratives, and social media misinformation. The risk of outside influence, harassment, or even just unintentional leaks was too high. So names were sealed. Jurors would be identified by number only, their backgrounds, their neighborhoods, their faces, shielded from public scrutiny. It's a standard measure in trials where safety or impartiality could be compromised, and this case qualified on both counts. By the end of the day, the courtroom felt like it had exhaled. The pool was intact. The judge's timeline was clear. The next step, final selection, was scheduled. Opening statements were locked in. There would be no dramatic last-minute derailments. And while the trial itself hadn't technically begun, the infrastructure was now in place to make it happen. No evidence had been shown. No witnesses had taken the stand. But don't let the quiet fool you. This was one of the most consequential phases of the entire trial, because these people, this group of now anonymous jurors, are the ones who will ultimately hear the evidence, weigh the testimony, and decide whether Sean Combs walks free or spends the rest of his life in a federal prison. The prosecution is expected to lay out a sweeping narrative of organized misconduct, coercion, and exploitation. The defense, meanwhile, has signaled they intend to fight every inch of that story with claims of false allegations, mischaracterizations, and ulterior motives. It's going to be intense, it's going to be complicated, and it's going to rely entirely on the judgment of a jury that, as of now, has not heard a single word of the case itself, but that's about to change. Next time we pick this up, the curtain finally rises. The jury gets seated, the lawyers make their opening moves, and the trial of Sean Diddy Combs officially begins.
The neighborhood was picture perfect. Manicured lawns, kids riding bikes, friendly smiles exchanged over white picket fences. And then there was him, the guy who never made eye contact, the one who only left his house at night, dragging black trash bags to the curb, bags that sometimes twitched. He's just a little odd, they said, just keeps to himself, until the smell started. Until the missing pets turned into missing people. Until someone finally had the nerve to peek inside that basement window. And if they had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, they could have listened to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi ad-free. And before everyone else, they could have recognized the warning signs. They could have gotten out. But they didn't. And now, they're part of the next episode. Don't make the same mistake. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.